L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avalon, author, journalist, historian, recent congressional candidate, and the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not simply focusing on fixating on the problems themselves. Now, we've got a lot of challenges in our country, particularly around our fragmentation, our demoralization, a decrease in trust. And one of the big ideas that touches culture, which after all lives downstream from politics, is the idea of restoring an expanded vision of national service. This is something I'm passionate about and something our guest this week has been an advocate for well over a decade. It is my pleasure and honor to welcome General Stanley McChrystal. Sir, welcome to How to Fix It.
John, you're kind to have me. Thank you.
So you also have a book on character I want to talk about and get a little bit of your insight into the military situation geopolitically, but I want to focus primarily on national service. You have been working on this issue through Serve America Together for well over a decade. I have read many of the essays you've written. You've accumulated an impressive coalition of co-workers on this effort. What progress have you seen, if any? Where are the stumbling blocks? And describe for people probably out of the gate how your vision would work.
Yeah, John, thanks for having me. First, philosophically, national service, in my view, is not about the work people do. It's not a works program or a jobs program. It is building better citizens. If we build better citizens down the road, I think we'll have a closer society, fewer divisions, more effectiveness. Make everybody feel like a shareholder in the American corporation, we'll call it.
Amen.
That's the purpose. And what we need to do is give young Americans the opportunity to serve. Now, people say, well, they can always go in the military, but in reality, only about 23% of young Americans qualify to go in the military, and they don't need every young American. So the reality is we have to give an opportunity for all young Americans from every part of the economic spectrum, every part of the political spectrum, geographic, and an opportunity potentially to work together. And so the idea is, if you take the experience of, for example, mine in the military, you got people from all over the country come together, they're formed into units, they start to understand people of different backgrounds, they start to get an appreciation for it, and they have a shared mission that is sometimes inconvenient and painful and occasionally dangerous. But it builds a bond between them. It also builds a confidence in each of them. So how do you make this work? Well, there are about 4 million young people in each cohort or year group in America. Our calculation was you need about 1 million of those, or 25%, doing service before it gets critical mass, meaning everybody knows somebody who's doing it. Everybody at the lunch table at school or in college is with someone who has done it. And then you start to have it accepted as, wow, that makes sense. And also employers go, you know, the people who've served a year in AmeriCorps, City Year, or in some other program, when they come to me, they're a little more mature. They're a little more focused. They've got a broader aperture on their thinking. And then employers start to say, okay, I would prefer to get people who are veterans, because this is really two sides of the same coin, military and civilian service. Employers would like to get that. And then we would like schools also. For example, if someone takes a year off between high school, if they decide to go to college, we'd like the college to go, boy, that's a real plus. And we consider that in the decision to give acceptance to somebody. And then you go down the line as this starts to get more momentum. And I could see a time where somebody wants to run for Congress, as you did, and they get up in front of a crowd of people. And one of the questions is, okay, where did you serve? And the answer is, if they didn't, and the opportunity was there, the practical opportunity, then they kind of look at their shoes, they shuffle around, and the crowd goes, well, why didn't you? And I'd like it to reach the point where it's an expectation. We don't have to make it mandatory. We make it an expectation, and you have to pay a stipend, because I think it has to be at least a year of full-time service. I think you have to give a stipend, not a huge amount of money, but you have to give it enough so that people whose parents can't support them during that year have the ability to participate as well. So they're not disadvantaged. So as they go for things later in life, the advantage of having been a veteran of this is open to everyone. All they've got to do is make the decision. And I think that what we would find is people would start to have a common connection. You go to Israel, and just about everybody serves in the military. They will argue about everything, but they start every conversation in, what brigade did you serve in? And so there is a connection that is pretty valuable. And we could create that same connection by giving people a practical opportunity to do conservation, health care, care of the elderly, all kinds of things that would be great additions to the American society while they're doing it, but even more valuable as these veterans move on into the next stage of life.
Look, there's no question America needs these common bonds. I've been a big advocate for the idea that we need a whole of government effort to strengthen American democracy, and building better citizens and a stronger sense of civics is part of this. I think a lot of folks hear service, obviously, and they look, you know, at someone like yourself. We have 52 years, I believe, since Nixon ended the draft. So we went to an all volunteer force. It just explain to people how the non-military side of service would work. You've indicated a couple of directions, yeah, a couple of programs. Does this build squarely on the AmeriCorps Foundation? You know, get into how that would work. And is there sort of a GI Bill component to this? Because it seems to me we can depolarize a lot of the conversation around student debt through this as well.
Yeah. First off, I'd say I don't believe anybody in America should get something for nothing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I believe that if you serve in the military or you do civilian service, there should be a benefit that comes that would look and feel like the GI Bill. We want to help young Americans go to college, but we don't want them to get it for nothing. I don't, because I think you value something you feel you earned. And we also don't want them to get buried in debt. And so I think this is a way to elegantly get everybody to do something that they feel like, I've earned this next benefit that I get from the government, and I go forward. The way it would look, I think it has to be a public-private partnership. You know, we could form the Department of National Service, and we could have every young American report to the middle of the country, and we could put them in big camps, and we could do all that kind of thing as a bureaucracy. I don't think that's the best approach. I think the best approach is to build on existing programs that are proven to work well. City Year, AmeriCorps, Teach for America, and their FEMA Corps. There are many permutations that have actually been remarkably effective, but they're too small. I mean, years ago, I think it was Sergeant Shriver who said the Peace Corps was a great thing, but it would never really do what we want until it got to 100,000 people a year. And we are a fraction of that now. And so you have to expand a number of the existing programs. And then you could have also more localized programs that are run by states and communities who are doing things in those areas. You can't just throw people at the problem without some good management of this, though, because nobody wants to send their sons and daughters into an environment if it's not safe. You don't want to put people out doing work that is clearly just make work, stupid stuff, because our young people are too smart for that. They will go, I just wasted a year. I went through motions. So you've got to be thoughtful about creating opportunities where they may do hard work. They may be building trails in national parks, but the reality is they can feel as though it's real work and it has value to it. And then, as I mentioned on the GI Bill equivalent, you can make it as similar to the GI Bill as you want. In fact, the term veteran has been applied to military service veterans. I'm not sure why we automatically limit it to that. If somebody is a veteran of serving the nation, I think that it would be great to open that term so that people are veterans in a more, in a broader sense. And I think that those little courtesies that we apply, like, you know, you're waiting to get on an airplane and you go, any active duty service member can now board. And if that would apply to people like AmeriCorps, City Year, there are a lot of young people who never get that kind of respect. Never once in their life will they have anybody come up and say, thank you for your service. But if we open this, I could see us running into people who are doing that kind of work. And we just take a second and go, thanks for what you're doing. And I think that changes the mindset a bit.
I agree. I mean, this goes back to the idea of, you know, we've got rights and responsibilities, that social contract in any citizen. You know, we need to lean into the responsibilities a little bit more. And I think that elevates everybody. But, you know, part of the problem is that this is, you know, first of all, for folks to understand, this is an idea with deep bipartisan support, at least in terms of lip service and advocacy. There's a William F. Buckley book called Gratitude, where he proposes national service in the late 1980s. You know, Bill Clinton pushed through AmeriCorps. It was, you know, expanded, you know, Teach for America and other things. Steve Goldsmith did a lot for that for the Bush administration. But when the rubber meets the road for the funding, our investment has been stalled. What have you found? Let's just identify the problem so we can fix it. Has been the problem with the broader adaptation, given the fact that so many folks left, right, and center say they support an expanded version of national service.
Yeah, it's been very perplexing and frustrating to me over the years. First off, I think that everybody has a slightly different version. If I talk to somebody who said, do you believe in national service? They say, yeah. And then they say, but it's got to be mandatory, or it's got to be this, or it's got to be that. And they put some little condition that they won't support the plan unless it meets their. So it's got to be a compromise solution that accomplishes it in the middle. There's a lot of people who refer to it as paid volunteerism, and it is not that. It's got a completely different purpose, as I started with citizenship. A friend of mine opined, and we worked together on this for a long time. He says it struggles from the fact that no one's against it. And so you don't have an enemy you fight through. It's not the civil rights kind of get through segregationists. I've come to the conclusion that what it lacks is the right kind of senior leadership. You know, I think it's going to take a president of the United States to get in front of people and say, this is an important program for me. All of them say, yeah, I support it. But none of them have gotten up on the podium and said, this is one of my top two or three priorities, and we are going to make this happen. We are going to use his bully pulpit, use other powers, bring in private business partnership to do this. No one's been willing to make that investment. And I'm not a politico, but I think it would be an extraordinarily powerful and popular position to take. And I'm surprised that nobody's really embraced it to the degree I wish they would.
So, you know, again, we have these toe holes, but they seem chronically underfunded. We had Biden pushed forward sort of a civilian conservation corps, but it does seem like if a Democrat puts something forward, Republicans are reflexively against it. Are there any bipartisan bills that you think would have a prayer of passing that would at least fund the existing structures in a more robust way?
I don't know that there's one right now because there's so much division. You've written so much about it. Senator McCain was a strong believer.
Yes, he was.
For a while, Senator Graham was. I don't know where he is on it now. You are going to have some people who are willing to grab this bipartisan. But again, most of them are looking for something to at least show their bipartisan bona fides. And so I'm surprised that they haven't tried to grab this one because, again, it's by nature apolitical.
You know, my hope is that in the upcoming Democratic presidential primaries, that multiple candidates will seize on this. Pete Buttigieg did in 2020. Wes Moore, governor of Maryland, has made his service year in Maryland an expanded version, significantly expanded version over what was started by his predecessor, Larry Hogan, into a signature issue. I mean, this is ripe for the idea that a Democrat's wanting to put forward a patriotic vision of how you to reunite the nation rooted in service, right? Nothing resembling something for nothing, as you just said. What have you had conversations with Wes Moore or Pete Buttigieg or people who are thinking about running for president about this issue?
I have. I'm good friends with Wes from back in the day, and I've gone up and testified for him in the legislature, and I'm excited about what he's doing. Pete Buttigieg, I've had conversations with him. He and there are a couple others who are, Seth Moulton's a strong supporter of it. There are several others that are pushing it, but I think it's going to take them to really raise, it can't be an additional thing they're for. They've got to put this thing pretty high.
Yeah.
And I think they could, to be honest, I think they could recapture the American flag. We have allowed the symbol of our nation to be almost co-opted by one part of our political spectrum right now. And I think you could take the flag and attach it to national service in a very genuine way. And you could get that flag back toward the center.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You're singing from my hymnal. I couldn't agree more. The budget bill that just passed has a lot of cuts. To what extent were initiatives like this, whether it's the civilian, you know, Climate Conservation Corps or Teach for America or AmeriCorps, to what extent have those been cut as far as you know?
Yeah, they've been constrained now for years. So they've almost been on life support, and the Civilian Conservation Act went through. But the reality was that was a help, but not a solution. And so these latest cuts just make it harder. Those programs are not gone, but they are not, they don't have any momentum. And they are, we hope that they will survive. I hope that they will survive long enough to be the foundation that you build on as we go forward. You know, with the search for cuts in anywhere possible to pay for the other things that were in that bill, it didn't have the advocacy to remain healthy.
Sure. You mentioned Lindsey Graham and the late Senator John McCain, the late great Senator John McCain. He certainly is a strenuous advocate. Lindsey Graham, as we've seen, is malleable on many issues. I'd like to think this is not one of them. But are there any other Republican senators that you've spoken to that you feel really do believe in this enough that they would reach across the aisle and be an advocate?
I know I've spoken to a number of them who have voiced the kind of support that you described earlier. But I think in the current environment, they have not been willing now to step away from anything that is, you know, the will of their party's leader. And so, unless you could get President Trump to stand up and full-throated, I don't think Republican senators are likely to to be very forthcoming.
That's a perfect segue to your recent book on character. I say that obviously with a dark irony and some despairing humor, because members of the United States Senate, a co-equal branch of government, should have the stones and the spine to advocate for what they believe is in the best interest of the United States. Long-term, ideally, not just short-term. And if folks are agreeing with you in private, but afraid to take a stand in public, I'd say that's outrageous, but that seems like kind of table stakes in Washington these days. That's an assumption. The issue of character, is core to democracy. I think, you know, I'm kind of a history nerd, and I wrote a book on George Washington's farewell address about the founders' conceptions of the Democratic Republic. And it was always very clear that one of the conditions that could allow democracy to succeed, a requirement, not an optional, is virtue, character. Democracies depend on the character of the average citizen, on a sense of civic virtue. Tell us about your book and why you felt called to write it right now.
Yeah, it's my fifth book, and it's unlike anything I've written, because I'm an aging guy. I'm 70, about to be 71.
You're very young 70, General.
And I got to a point in life where everything that you focus on earlier in life seems less important than it did. And I realized that the most important thing was always character, but it becomes more obvious to me as I get this age. The things that I hope to project to people, the things I would like to be remembered for, the places where my character was what I wished it would be and the places where it wasn't, you know, they form important memories of my life. And so what I've done in the book is try to offer a number of subjects and not give any prescriptive answer on what character is, but ask people to consider these so they can explore. And I've defined character in a way that I think goes very closely with what you've written. It's a mathematical equation. It's the product of your convictions, your values, or deeply held beliefs, times the discipline you have to live up to them. Because you can have all the great ideas and values in the world, but if you don't have the courage and discipline to behave to them, they're pointless, because anything times zero is zero. And so I've reached the point where I think individual character in America has eroded because we haven't demanded it. We give our money, our social media likes, our votes and all to people who advertise character that we don't really respect. And on a cumulative level, because I think there is such a thing as national or societal character, we have equally let it erode because we haven't made it a standard. And so you said a democracy doesn't really work unless there is virtue in people. And I think that's absolutely true. And cumulatively, there have to be the guardrails or the normative pressures towards better character to make a democracy work. Because if there are no rules, if there are no expectations, people can behave in any way they want. And they can just go, well, this is just what I do. And this is kind of what I think what's happened in our Congress. We have gotten to a place where nobody feels constrained by norms that used to govern behavior. Now, they weren't perfect. There was always problems, as you know, historically. But the reality is, if people feel unconstrained to do things that we need people to do, then we're weak.
Well, this gets back to the issue of guardrails, of democratic norms, of things that were civically expected. And look, perfect's never on the menu. You don't need to whitewash folks in the past or, you know, put them on a pedestal. I think it's the wrong way to gain inspiration from history. But it's clear we need to rebuild guardrails. What do you view as the ways that we cultivate, that we inculcate character in our society again?
Yeah, I've come to this conclusion, but I'm not confident it's the only answer. I'm pushing for a national conversation on character. I make this comparison that you'd understand, but I don't want people to misread it. When the Taliban came into Afghanistan in 1994, they came after 10 years of war with the Soviets and then a brutal civil war. And the Taliban were idealistic, pretty extremely religious young men who came in to throw the bastards out. You know, they were incorruptible. They were a little bit narrow, and they turned out to be, in many cases, sort of knuckleheads. But the intent wasn't a bad thing, because these warlords were absolutely, you know, plundering the country and running things in an extraordinarily negative way. And the Taliban said, enough is enough. I almost think that in America, we need a national conversation on character that says, okay, enough is enough. We are not going to put up with it. And I think it needs to start at the grassroots levels, in schools, in families, in churches. I don't think we can wait for a national politician to be lowered down from on high, who's going to be this, because I think that would be another bewitching demagogue. Mm-hmm. And we need, at the very lowest level, say, this is how we are going to run our neighborhood, our village, our town, our community, our city. And we are going to vote this way. We are going to contribute this way. And we are not going to tolerate the foolishness. Now, I sound like Pollyanna here, because I know that information technology and all makes this hard, but I don't think it makes it impossible. And I think we could almost have, like the days when, you know, young people joined temperance movements or they religious revivals. What's wrong with a revival of character? It doesn't have to be religious. It could simply be a revival of the American character. And it could be elastic enough so it's not this corseting, narrow definition, but something that stays within guardrails, but allows each of us to be ourselves.
For folks who lack any sense of perspective or humor or irony, you know, you're not calling for an American Taliban to restore virtue, obviously. But what you're saying is that, you know, there needs to be reform movements that are grassroots, led by people who are uncorruptible and put principle over party politics. And I do think that hyperpartisanship has been one of the vehicles that allows people to abandon their character. One of my favorite quotes is by Václav Havel, who said, ideology, it's a form of hyperpartisanship, I suppose, ideology creates the illusion of dignity and morals while making it easier to part with them. And that's the problem with the teamism we've got in our politics right now. And we are going to have to break through. I mean, I look to civic education along with national service as two things that might be able to help inculcate this culture that we need to restore. We have to lean into the American story. It has to be patriotic, but it can be good, the bad, and the ugly. It should be. That's reality. But the Democrats need to take a lead on that as well. Take back the flag. As it were. I don't know if there are any civic education programs that you particularly admire, but if there are, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I'm involved in a couple of organizations, More Perfect and More Perfect Union, and they're basically trying to be apolitical efforts to bring back civic education, to bring back local media, because, as you know, as media all becomes nationalized, it's partisan and it doesn't address local things. A point was made to me, someone like George Santos could never have been elected if you'd had a really vibrant local media putting him through due diligence before he ran for Congress. And so you need things like that, which give fiber back into our democracy, because I think it's actually been pulled up. You know, the consolidation of media, the ability of people to transmit at no cost to huge groups of people makes that bullhorn more effective. And so I think we've got to go in that other direction.
Yeah, I'll say that there was a very small local paper, the North Shore Leader, that reported on Santos, but it had no pickup because it wasn't seen as competitive. And Newsday did not do the reporting that they should have. And this is all what happens when local media gets starved and takes its eye off the investigative ball. It is a critical issue. I want to ask you one more question on character, and then I want to do a geopolitical tour with you.
Sure.
I find myself, despairing is a word I would never use, but deeply concerned that the old admonition that character is destiny no longer holds.
that shamelessness has become a superpower in our politics, and particularly rooted in the character of our current president. I'm not trying to drag you into a partisan battle here, but let's just deal with facts. Donald Trump has never advertised character as a civic strength of his. In fact, very much the opposite. And yet folks fall for it, excuse it, dismiss it. But I do worry about the messages it sends.
L-E-T-E-N-E-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The message it sends about our country to our kids and to the world. Do you think character is destiny?
I do. Much more so than most people would admit. I think back to the Joseph McCarthy moment when I think it was Secretary or General Counsel of the Army said, "Have you no shame?" I think we are going to get to that moment, or we're going to see the protesters standing in front of the Chinese tank in Tiananmen Square. We are going to have some people who finally stand up. And there may be a bunch of them run over by tanks before suddenly it resonates with the American people and people go, that's not acceptable. When that happens, I think there are going to be a number of people who have mortgaged their character or sold their soul for political expediency. And they are, many of them will try to moonwalk away from it, but it won't be credible. And I think there'll be many regrets. There'll be a lot of people who in their lifetimes regret it, and in their children and grandchildren's lifetime, it will be difficult to live down. I don't know when that moment comes. I hope it comes soon. But I think the idea that you can't step away from the importance of character and have that, you know, endure.
I'm with you on that. I've got a framed photograph of Tank Man in my office back when I was at CNN. But why didn't it happen after January 6th?
Yeah.
How do you understand, given that you believe that character is destiny, do you understand with a sense of history the fact that our country elected Donald Trump again after January 6th? How come that didn't break the fever?
I think because we didn't understand the nature of the support for Donald Trump. And I think he's a symptom, not the cause, but he happened to hit a tuning fork that resonates, because I think there's a number of people who just lost faith in the elites, lost faith in the idea that things are fair. And so when a proposition was put forward that it's been stolen and we've got to go retake it, that that resonated with a certain group of people. But the most disappointing is the wider group of people who accept, they knew that was wrong. They were absolutely aware that wasn't the case, but they thought that there was something to gain in having Donald Trump elected again because of the things that he was promising to do, whether it's in immigration or tax cuts or whatever. And those are the people I worry most about, the people who understand, people who absolutely believe, I think they're doing what they think is right. I may disagree, but there's a certain ability to respect that. I think there's a bunch of people who think that many of the things they see are wrong, but they say, I'm willing to live with a certain amount of this wrongness because it benefits me. It gets me something I want. That is very disappointing to me. I think that population is in a bad place.
That is an epidemic in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And the fact you haven't heard more people call it out clearly, and those who have tend to be the ones excommunicated. That's about character, and that's what we need to cure. That's what we need to inculcate. We need to be clear-eyed about that. Before we let you go, you oversaw U.S. forces in Afghanistan. I want your sense of the U.S. In the various military theaters. It's a term I hate, but I just used it. What is your perspective on the U.S. posture in Ukraine and a certain crowd that has indulged in appeasement of Vladimir Putin? Now, Trump in recent weeks seems to have pushed against this. But just given your experience, what's your perspective on what the U.S. needs to do in Ukraine?
This is one person's opinion, so I'd ask everybody to handicap it accordingly. I think that we should have supported Ukraine more strongly from the beginning. I think Putin was much weaker than we thought. You know, we thought of them as the Soviet Union. They are not that anymore. They are Russia under an aging autocrat. I think we should have given a blank check, essentially, to Ukraine. I don't think we need to put forces on the ground. If we gave a clear blank check that said, we're going to do whatever it takes to reverse what Russia has done, I think that that would have been effective. Now, it might very well have produced regime change in Russia, and I'm okay with that. I think that that's a better outcome than if we allow Russia to succeed in this, because, again, I think we can make all the historical analogies you want, but a successful autocratic dictator taking additional territory is not a good precedent to set.
Yeah, history is pretty clear about that. Let's talk about the Middle East, the expanded map. I mean, you dealt with proxies funded and supported by Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran does seem like it has been decidedly swatted back. You can, from the destruction of the leader of the Hezbollah to, the strike on its nuclear facilities, which you can compare to Osirak or anything else. But what's your sense of the state of play in that region?
I think that it's where I never thought it would be. I thought Iran would show up stronger than they have. Hezbollah was stronger. They turned out to be much weaker. Even Hamas has been ground down to a great degree. I think we've got an opportunity now to reshape the Middle East for the future. But I think it's going to take American involvement in a significant way. I think that it is possible that Iran may be more malleable, you know, for generations now, we've been waiting for that more reasonable part of the Iranian society to take over, but they have not yet been able to do it. But I don't think that's impossible. I think we contain Iran and continue to push for and hope for that, because they are a democracy. They may not be a perfect democracy, but there's much to argue for trying to bring them into the community of nations. I think that the traditional Arab states who wanted to destroy Israel have backed off that idea. The only people who say it now are Iran and then some of the groups. And so I think that now is a time we could look at a longer lasting opportunity. But I think it means that you need a two-state solution in Palestine. You need an enduring possibility. Israel is expansive right now, and that's a trap. They
what do you mean?
Well, they can go too far. They can be now looked at as a regional hegemon, and then they become a threat. And when they a greater threat, and then when they become a greater threat, you're going to get more and more groups who will use them as, you know, the traditional enemy. And so it really argues against the ability to try to get an enduring agreement. I'd like to believe that Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, the leadership in the UAE and other states could take a practical approach with Israel. And if Israel could sort of step back and say, what do we really want long term? Because what we are doing right now is not sustainable.
And you know, as you indicated, I mean, it's been said nowhere is there a greater gap between the people of a country and their government than in Iran. Yeah. But there does need to be, it's going to be based on sort of a a regional peace rooted in the Abraham Accords and Arab states that recognize Israel's right to exist and a focus on trade. Clearly from Syria to Iran, there's a lot of moves out. I want to close by just, does it break your heart to see the Taliban back in control of Afghanistan?
It does. I spent a long time there, and the Afghan people really, you know, kind of got into me. You know, I really appreciated them and loved them. They missed a lot of opportunities. They didn't do a lot of things they could have and should have done. But the reality is Taliban leadership is, it's inept. I mean, it's extreme, and I disagree with that, but it's also not practically effective leadership either. So the country's going to suffer on two ways. It's going to be led by extremists, and it's going to be incompetently led by extremists. And that makes the people just vulnerable to this sort of grinding life of poverty and a lack of opportunity. And, you know, we gave about 20 years of opportunity for females to go to school, and there was progress. It was certainly imperfect and incomplete, but a lot of them saw enough daylight that, you know, that is something they still would like to have. So it's tough to watch.
It is. And I'll state also a lot of the recent budget cuts make it even worse. We've cut funding for kids. We've left some of the Afghan Adjustment Act that many of us hoped had been, you know, would be put in place so we would keep our word to our Afghan allies and interpreters that they've been isolated. Those problems have been compounded. I wonder when you see someone like J.D. Vance, who served in the region, I think he was primarily Iran, sort of saying that that era of wars was a fundamental mistake. You know, how you internalize that as you look for a path forward that redeems the promise of that period?
Yeah, I think he is partially right. I think that we went to Afghanistan after 2001 almost because we had to. Al-Qaeda was there and the Taliban. So, I mean, there was a reason. And then once we got there, because Afghanistan had then been through 20 years of destructive war, you know, you kind of had to help them get back into the world. And so I don't damn us for the effort. I think we didn't do it particularly effectively, but I don't disagree with the effort to do that. I think the decision to invade Iraq was a mistake. I thought so at the time. I didn't think that it was illegal or immoral. I thought it was unnecessary. I thought Saddam Hussein was like ripe fruit that was going to fall off and go away at some point anyway. And so I think that we stuck ourselves into an area that was so complex and so fraught that it's not surprising we had big issues. And I just don't think we thought it through enough.
Well, General Stanley McChrystal, thank you for your service, and thank you for your leadership over the past decade pushing forward for national service. That's the focus of our conversation, what I hope people take away. You know, we can't take American democracy for granted, and we really need to throw ourselves in to an effort to strengthen it. And it starts with us. It starts with the citizens inculcating a sense of character, civic virtue, and civic service. And that's what you have advocated for and embodied. Thank you, sir.
Couldn't agree more. And thank you for all you've written and said as well.
Thank you.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.